I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold talks about fracking with financial reporter Bethany McLean and investment banker Jim Chanos. Fracking has long been controversial because of its effect on the environment, and it may also have a destructive effect on the economy.
In some parts of the country right now, that sound, hydraulic drills and compressors used in fracking, is a constant presence. In Texas, the Dakotas, Pennsylvania, and other places too, fracking has given us an energy boom. It's made the U.S. into the world's leading producer of oil and gas by some estimates. Fracking, of course, has been controversial. It creates a lot of methane, which is a greenhouse gas. It's been blamed for poisoning water tables and other environmental consequences. Eliza Griswold's been writing a lot on the fracking industry, and she's discovered that it's controversial in other ways as well. Here's Eliza.
I've been looking into fracking for 7 years. I've been in people's farms and in their backyards, looking at the human costs of America's energy boom. One of the things about fracking that has always been true is that for the companies, it's very expensive.
The key ingredient in fracking isn't so much chemicals as it is capital. It was an extraordinarily expensive proposition.
That's Bethany McLean. She's a financial journalist who brought down Enron, and she's written a new book, Saudi America. One of Bethany's key insights is that fracking wouldn't have been possible without the 2008 financial crisis. What happened is that the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates dramatically, and that made borrowing money very cheap. That meant companies could raise money hand over fist. And fracking companies, many of which weren't really turning a profit, were suddenly awash in cash just because the cost of borrowing money was so low. Jim Chanos, a very well-known hedge fund manager, agrees that this was the moment critical to the industry.
There was no way this would have happened on the scale it had without Wall Street embracing it and providing willingly providing capital to this industry.
Growth in this industry has been remarkable. Tens of thousands of wells have gone in all over the country. Hundreds of thousands of miles of pipeline crisscross the landscape. If you look at all of this infrastructure that has sprung up as a result of easy money, you could say that fracking is a monument to the 2008 financial crisis. So I met with Bethany and Jim, not at some rural well site, but where the action really happens, in a swank office in Midtown Manhattan.
So fracking was initially sold as an environmental positive, that it would be a bridge fuel to cleaner energy economy. Did that turn out to be the case?
So I think it's complicated. I think natural gas, there's some arguments that it is a cleaner fuel because of because it's replacing coal and thereby lowering carbon emissions. But as the frackers produce so much natural gas that they totally crush the price of natural gas, they instead switch to oil. And so most of the value in fracking, or most of what people think about with fracking today, is not so much natural gas. It's actually oil.
As Bethany points out, the frackers have been so successful in producing natural gas prices that they collapsed the price. And so it is very cheap, and a lot of it's just simply flared off these days, not even used.
Mm-hmm. So a crisis is always an opening for new ways of thinking. And Jim, where did you and others of your contemporaries, where did your associates see opportunities after the crash in energy?
So I began to educate myself and my team here on the economics of fracking and how it was different from, say, the integrated oil business. When Exxon would drill a deep well after a lot of testing, they were pretty certain that if they said the well had probably a 20 to 40 year life, it probably had a 20 to 40 year life. And that once the well was drilled, it was annual maintenance and worker salaries, whatever, to keep the rig going. It was different in the fracking. There, because of the nature of the technology, the energy was released at the front end of your drilling process and then declined rapidly. It meant that you had to keep putting more and more money in to keep your production even steady.
So, Jim, you started seeing flaws in the numbers in 2010.
We were starting to see evidence in Chesapeake and some of the others, the earlier frackers, that if you just did some calculations and you realized how much money they were reinvesting back in the business, it should have yielded even more production than it was. And so what it meant to us basically was that they were overstating profits. And so it had this vicious cycle, because what happened was money flooded in, not only because of the Federal Reserve's easy policy, but because the companies looked better than they really were. They've managed to convince Wall Street, typically on the back of a lot of debt raised, that 2 + 2 = 5. And Wall Street loves that equation.
The most famous example from that is actually before the crisis. It's from the bankruptcy of WorldCom back in the early 2000s. And the WorldCom scandal essentially was WorldCom taking all of the costs that should have been running through its income statement and figuring out ways to put them on its balance sheet instead, so that its reported profits looked much, much better than they were. And that was the essence of the WorldCom fraud. And that's probably the most famous one you can point to. Am I wrong?
And the CEO is still in prison for that, doing that.
Wow. Why don't we call it accounting fraud when it comes to fracking?
It's a good question.
Well, sometimes things are only accounting fraud after a bankruptcy, right? So that's one issue. But accounting is an art rather than a science, and there's an awful lot of latitude in it. So sometimes things you can look at and say are misleading are not necessarily something that a prosecutor would find illegal.
One other little thing to note on this, and it's you find these things in the places that are sort of a little harder to look. One of the reasons that kept us attracted to this industry as short sellers is all the ways in which the fracking management was able to enrich itself off the top, if you will. Often management, you had to look at their incentive compensation and how they were paid. And in many cases, it was on production, which is kind of an important point, because even when it was uneconomic to produce, if they could raise money, they would produce, because their bonus pool would be bigger based on production, not profitability.
Bethany, you have been really careful to say that the verdict is still out on fracking, but you've also described fracking as an unintentional Ponzi scheme. What do you mean by that? And what are the consequences for the future? Because eventually all Ponzi schemes collapse.
There are some companies that are making some money today. And so to me, the key question isn't so much the financial one. It's actually kind of the more existential one. If the companies stop being funded by this avalanche of cheap capital, how much energy can they actually produce? How much oil and gas can they actually produce? How the good acreage there, the really key acreage in the core, how far does that extend? And so to me, that's the key question, is what will this be revealed to be eventually? I don't know from a financial standpoint that it ever becomes a calamity, but it becomes a calamity if we depend on this oil and gas and think it's going to grow forever. I think Jim may have a slightly more skeptical take than I do.
Well, as you know, we did just a look back at the last 5 years of the industry. And the reason that was sort of convenient was it took us over a period of better and better fracking technology, but prices that were very high, that went very low, and are back to high. The 5 years also coincides with basically the average life of one of these wells. And the figure was negative for the entire industry. So for the entire industry, in a complete cycle, price cycle, in fracking, and it was uneconomic. It was free cash flow negative for the investors. And so Wall Street will be willing to overlook that when times are good, but when they get fearful, they shut off capital.
So is there a parallel then to be made between fracking now and mortgages in the 2000s?
I think there is a parallel to be made in that during a bubble, capital can be put to uses that in retrospect will clearly be seen to be uneconomic, right? And so in the run-up to the financial crisis, you had banks, lenders making mortgages to people who didn't have a hope of paying them back. And afterwards you say, how could that have happened? And there's an explanation for it, but most of it was a mania. People forgot about the idea that somebody had to pay the money back. And so I think there's an analogy to this today when I get asked the question, why on earth would Wall Street fund these guys? This is uneconomic. You must be wrong. I say, no. Just look at the history of Wall Street. They funded plenty of things that are uneconomic at the end of the day. And you realize Wall Street's incredibly short term. The idea that they're going to be taking into account something that might happen even in a decade is just, it's beyond the reach of today's capital markets, I think.
That was Bethany McLean and Jim Chanos talking to Eliza Griswold.